12 News. This is Newsmakers.
1 year ago this week, insurrection at the Capitol. Shocking images drove home the depths of the nation's political divide following the 2020 election. Now, a year later, that chasm may be greater than before, with Democrats crying for justice and punishment. Yet a recent poll shows two-thirds of Republicans say what happened on January 6th was either patriotism or defending freedom. Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White, alongside 12 News politics editor Ted Nesi. And joining us via Zoom this week is U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Senator, it's good to have you. We were hoping to have you in studio, but Mother Nature and COVID had different plans for all of us.
Yeah, they did.
Let's start with January 6th, Senator. When you reflect on that day, what experience that you had that day comes to your mind first?
It was watching the outside mob surge through the bicycle fences that were the outer perimeter around the Capitol, and not seeing the Capitol Police fall back to the building itself, but stay out in the middle of the crowd, and then hearing the loud noise of the attack on the building, and then a very upset Capitol police officer being brought to shelter in my Capitol office by other Capitol police officers, and telling me in a very shaken voice, "They're in the building. They're in the building."
Wow. Was that officer that was brought into your office, was he or she injured?
No, but very, very frightened.
You know, I haven't heard you, I'm sure you've told that story before, Senator, but I hadn't heard it about the officer in your office. Were you concerned? I think we've talked so much about January 6th in the last year, people can forget kind of what the rawness of the day. Did you feel concern for the safety of your fellow lawmakers? Maybe not yourself if you were in your office, but the people on the floor?
There was a moment when I was walking through the basement towards our Senate secure location, and there were Capitol Police officers who were escorting me, and it came across their radio that shots had been fired on the House side. And that was pretty chilling, because it wasn't clear to me that this mob didn't have firearms, and they were already doing an enormous amount of damage. And you'd seen the images of them attacking police officers, you know, beating helpless police officers. So the notion that a shot had been fired, you know, it was a very sad thing that it was the Capitol Police that had to shoot and defend the House chamber itself. But it could have been a lot worse when you think of the mass shootings we've seen elsewhere. So that was the moment where I thought that this could have been a really appalling day. Appalling enough even without that.
So obviously there's a lot of different criminal inquiries going on stemming from January 6th. Attorney General Garland gave a speech Wednesday outlining how the Justice Department is conducting its investigation. You always comment on how the Justice Department's doing its work since you're a former U.S. attorney. And you said in response, quote, "Sweeping up low-level players while ignoring the kingpins upstream isn't a full investigation." Sounds like you're not satisfied with the scope of how DOJ has been investigating January 6th so far, or are you?
Well, if you look at Merrick Garland's speech, he says things that are true about investigations that involve a whole lot of different players. And one is that you start with the easier cases and you try to flip people. If this were a drug case, Tim and Ted, you've covered a lot of those things. You'd start with the street dealers. You try to flip them to get the distributors. You try to make your cases against the distributors to flip them and get them to tell you what was going on with the drug kingpins. And that's the analogy here. So far, what the Department of Justice has done is basically to prosecute trespassers, the people who broke into the building. And in some cases, they've added a conspiracy count because they broke into the building in a little group. But they haven't gone upstream. And I think what Merrick Garland was saying is, trust me, I get this. This is the normal stage of our investigation, and we are going to continue to look upstream. He said that quite plainly, and then by laying out the way these investigations ordinarily work, I think he was trying to provide reassurance that they weren't going to just do the trespassers and then close the case and walk on.
Well, I mean, you can't predict where a case is going to go. You've done so many of these, Senator. I mean, what is it possible that there is no upstream? We have been hearing from a lot of people who went into the Capitol now as they've been sentenced that they were just following the herd. It was that sort of herd mentality. Is it possible there won't be the evidence to support, I think, what it is that you're looking for here?
Yeah, absolutely. What there is at this point, I think, is what a prosecutor would call very clear predication for an investigation of higher-ups. And you don't know what that investigation will show. You don't know what evidence will be produced. But clearly, there's cause for the Department of Justice to look upstream, whether it's the hotel room meetings, whether it's following the money of people who funded all of this, whether it's getting your hands on the communications between the members of Congress who are objecting to the vote count and the attackers outside, and whether those two efforts were coordinated together. There's a lot left to be learned, but I think Jamie Raskin from the January 6th Commission said it very well. He said basically there are three circles here. There's the outer circle of people who trespassed in the building, broke in, and damaged the facilities and harmed police officers. And then there are the organizations like QAnon and Proud Boys and Oath Keepers who you can go after in a whole bunch of different ways, including the way people went after the Ku Klux Klan and shut them down with civil judgments. And then there's that innermost circle, and it's that innermost circle that we know not enough about yet, but clearly predication to investigate that innermost circle.
One last question on January 6th before we move on. You know, if you look at the election results last year, it was in many ways close to a 50-50 election, especially down ballot. It was not a landslide for the Democrats in the wake of the first Trump term. The country is still deeply, deeply divided. How do you balance the need to figure out what happened on January 6th and the attack on the Capitol with the need for try to have some kind of national unity that stretches beyond, you know, 51-49 and the country being divided as deeply as it is right now?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Ted, and it's a hard one, and it's one that I live with every day with my colleagues in the Senate. I think there are some touchstones as we do this, and I think one of those touchstones is telling the truth. If one party is telling the truth and the other party is gaslighting, and you compromise at something that is less than the truth, then you're not doing anyone a real service. So for me, the touchstone is telling the truth. And one of the hardest things for me has been friends on the Republican side who have been unable to push back on what is a flagrant lie by Donald Trump. We were all there together. We shared this experience. We know what happened. We know he's lying. They know he's lying. They know we know it. And yet we're kind of stuck in this strange world in which, like, there's some awful family secret that you can't discuss.
Well, with these, you know, two different truths, as you point out, there are a lot of scholars that are concerned this country is on the brink of a civil war. And I know that sounds pretty extreme, but one a scholar warned the Canadian government to prepare writing in a op-ed by 2025, American democracy could collapse, causing extreme domestic political instability, including widespread civil violence. Do you share these concerns, Senator?
I put them on the horizon, I guess I would say, but I think they're real and I think they're there. And I think we need to really redouble our efforts to make sure that we don't end up in that place. Democracies have failed before, and they fail when propaganda overcomes truth. They fail when power overcomes principle, and they fail when leaders become cult leaders rather than leaders of proper principle. And we're seeing all those factors now in the United States of America. So the threat, I think, is very, very real. It's one of the reasons that I think our voting rights bill is so important. Because if you got to a situation where a Republican-controlled state legislature could ignore the votes of the citizens of that state and install their own members of Congress or their own presidential electors, you then get into a situation which very, very basic foundations of democracy have been destroyed, and it's hard to rebuild them once they're destroyed.
Let's talk about the voting rights legislation that Democrats are prioritizing. Now, look, you know the Senate math better than I do. The Democrats have 50 votes plus Kamala Harris. Joe Manchin has said he won't change the filibuster for voting rights, so that leaves you unable to pass that bill. What is the point of an exercise where you already know the outcome is going to fail? You know, why not enter into bipartisan negotiation, see if there's something you could do that would actually become law?
Well, first of all, there's no bipartisan way to do this. Unfortunately, I wish that there were. But Mitch McConnell has told his people that this is a red line and there's going to be no negotiation or compromise on the key elements of the bill. Would they change the election law? Perhaps they floated that. But the key things, and one of them is the corrupting power of dark money and being able to hide spending billions of dollars in politics, those are things that Mitch will never let us do. So we really have to focus on getting it done in our caucus. And I would be a little bit less gloomy than you are about where Joe Manchin is, because conversations are going on as we speak with Manchin and his team about trying to find a way through this. You don't necessarily need to get rid of the filibuster to find a way around it. We got around the filibuster for Build Back Better through the budget reconciliation process. We got around the filibuster on the debt limit with an agreement with Mitch McConnell. There are ways around it, and it's trying to find that way that Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin will accept that is the task at hand.
But do you feel at all a little bit like with Senator Manchin that could be Lucy with the football? I mean, you got through the budget reconciliation filibuster, but Build Back Better didn't happen because Manchin at the last minute said no. Why wouldn't he just do the same playbook this time around?
Yeah, I think the Lucy with the football analogy is kind of a good one. I think there's an awful lot of pressure on Joe right now, not to change his deeply held principles, but to be more forthcoming about what he would accept and not be, to use another analogy, you know, Dr. Seuss, green eggs and ham. Would you like it in a train? Would you like it on a plane? Would you like it here? Would you like it there? Would you like it in a house? Would you like it with a mouse? We can't be just shopping alternatives to him for him to say no, 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 no. He has a moral obligation to his colleagues and an obligation of responsibility as a negotiator to put forward what it is that he would accept or just say, I'm out, none. There's no point talking to me, it's over. But he's in a kind of gray area between those two things, and both on Build Back Better and on this, our Democratic objectors, I think, have a real obligation now to put forward what it is that they would accept if they won't accept what we have proposed.
All right, Senator, we do have to go to a break here, but quickly before we do, with some developing news, we think sources tell us you're going to be a grandfather soon. Is that right?
Indeed. In February, Valentine's Day, perhaps, for a baby granddaughter, and I couldn't be more excited except for watching my wife, Sandra, who is actually more excited.
Well, it still must be mind-blowing to you and Sandra to think that you're going to be a grandparent.
Yeah, we had Christmas with the kids, and watching my daughter become a much larger person carrying her little daughter is quite a sight to see. I wish it on both of you.
Well, let's slow it down. Let's slow that train down a little bit. But all right, we're going to take a break here on Newsmakers. Our guest this week is Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Stay with us. You're watching Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White alongside 12 News Politics editor Ted Nisi. Our guest this week is U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. He is joining us via Zoom. Ted?
Senator, there's an increasingly heated debate, I would say, in the Democratic Party about the party's trajectory. Took off even more after the losses in Virginia and New Jersey. High-profile example just last week, Hillary Clinton. She told an interviewer, quote, "I think that it is time for some careful thinking about what wins elections, and not just in deep blue districts where a Democrat and a liberal Democrat or a so-called progressive Democrat is going to win." Do you share that concern?
I do. And I think the solution to that concern is to be successful at delivering for the American people with real things, which is why Build Back Better is so important, and also to be seen by the American people to be on the right side of important fights, which is why I think the climate change issue can be a much bigger political advantage for us than it has been. I think those are two examples of ways that we can do things that bring the party together and that project to voters something more convincing than Joe Biden fighting with Joe Manchin.
I did just see, though, former Montana Governor Steve Bullock had an op-ed in the New York Times on this debate over how Democrats can do better in non-deep blue places. And he actually warned against talking too much about climate change because he felt that it didn't speak to day-to-day concerns, especially for a lot of voters in more rural or conservative-leaning areas. Do you see a tension there? I know what a priority that issue is for you.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing polling that shows, you know, even among Republicans, concern about climate change growing through the roof. I'm seeing core Democratic constituencies like young voters, for whom this is the most significant issue, and for whom energy and enthusiasm matter a lot. These aren't duty voters, these are enthusiasm voters, and you've got to meet them at their points of enthusiasm, and we haven't really succeeded at that. And I think that going from the climate debate is that this is actually a contest between an industry that has hidden a huge array of fake science, propaganda, and dirty political spending in order to obstruct the proper operation of the United States Congress. And if you're just talking about a polar bear while people are suffering with their paychecks and COVID, yeah, then you've blown it. But if you're talking about the economic impact of climate change, what we're already seeing in terms of families having their homes burned out by fires and coastal families losing their homes to floods, and that there's a reason for this and there's a bad guy in the story and we're gonna go in and fix it, I think that's a much different story to tell and a much more important narrative and, you know, added benefit of being true.
Senator, marijuana is inching ever closer to legalization in Rhode Island. Honestly, it's just a matter of what that legislation is going to look like. First, I'm not sure where you stand on this. Do you support statewide legalization of marijuana here in Rhode Island?
I have not. I've got enough going on in Congress that I haven't made any effort to address that issue with the Rhode Island General Assembly. I trust them to make good decisions. I think the medicinal use of marijuana was a sensible decision. I worry that it is addictive, it is dangerous, it does have health effects. We don't know enough about it. And, you know, we got to be careful about just opening its use entirely. But I think the state officials who have the job of deciding that are well positioned to make the right decision for Rhode Island.
You were both a Rhode Island Attorney General and U.S. Attorney. And as marijuana is being more widely accepted, you prosecuted a lot of marijuana cases. Any second thought now, hindsight being 2020, on those cases now that marijuana has essentially been decriminalized?
Yeah, it's been a while now, but I don't think we prosecuted marijuana users. We prosecuted drug dealer organizations. And there was often a lot of overlap between organizations dealing marijuana and organizations dealing cocaine or heroin or other drugs. Once you're a drug dealing organization, you'll put through the system whatever you can sell. So I do think, and I had a, I think, pretty solid informal policy that we don't prosecute marijuana use. The only times I can recall even thinking about that was when a case against a dealer had gone south in some way, and the best we could end up with was a simple possession case just to get something. You know, there was an evidentiary problem, a police officer had become unreliable witness, whatever it was. So I feel fairly comfortable about where we were. And I worked very, very hard to make sure that we had the drug court up and going. And I've been a really staunch advocate for treatment. My CARA bill is the biggest treatment bill the Congress has ever done. And I think law enforcement is turning in the right direction. I've been supportive of that turn. And the latest step, frankly, is making sure that mental health care and addiction care are right at the front in law enforcement.
We want to ask you about the pandemic. We've had so much to talk about, we haven't brought it up yet. You know, Congress has appropriated an enormous amount of money related to the pandemic. We've been in this almost 2 years. President Biden promised to turn things around, and yet, as you know, Rhode Islanders amid this Omicron variant are waiting a long, long time to be able to get tests. There's so much disruption. Are you frustrated that as we nearly enter the third year of the pandemic, the basic response on things like testing is still such a mess?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few baselines we should remember. We developed a vaccine for an unprecedented new disease in absolute record time and deployed it very broadly. And the main reason people aren't vaccinated is because they've chosen not to be. It's not a problem of vaccine availability. And that's been a huge and important success. I think on the testing, the Biden administration dropped the ball because they were focused so much on making sure people were vaccinated. And I don't think they appreciated, or many people appreciated, that a new variant could sweep so rapidly through even vaccinated people and move very rapidly through the population. And the testing would reemerge as such an important part of the response. But even in those circumstances, the vaccination piece is still really big, because if you ask Rhode Island Hospital, if you ask Care New England, what they're seeing is an awful lot of unvaccinated people who are the ones who have to be hospitalized. People I know who've had Omicron can go home and have a few days with symptoms and come back. If you're not vaccinated, you're likely to end up in the hospital. There was one hospital system that said 85% of its hospitalized COVID patients were unvaccinated. So I think the Biden's administration's focus on the vaccine is the real lifesaver. And now that we're going to get, what, 500 million tests out in the mail through the Postal Service, I think they're responding. It should have happened sooner, for sure.
On a much lighter note, I thought one piece of legislation that might have some bipartisan support is your effort to make daylight savings permanent. So getting rid of that, you know, fall back on the clock that we so dread. What are you hearing is the pushback on this legislation? Seems pretty popular.
Yeah, there actually isn't a whole lot of pushback. It's really, I think, more a question of priorities. And in the middle of the pandemic, with Build Back Better, with the voting rights crisis that we have going on across the country, I don't think my colleagues are entirely focused on daylight savings time. And I am totally with them on that. It shouldn't be our priority right now, but we do have to get that solved. It is ridiculous for people to be driving home in the pitch dark at 4:30 in the afternoon.
We're coming up on an election year. We're in an election year now, actually. McKee is the incumbent governor, but he's drawn multiple primary challengers. Are you going to make an endorsement in that primary?
My practice has been to endorse the endorsed candidate of the party. We have an immense field of talent with some very interesting participants. And I think it's incumbent on all of them to make their cases to Democratic voters and to the public at large, so that the Democratic Party can make an informed choice about who the best candidate to put forward will be.
And looking ahead to the next election, you will be, or you could be, depending on what you decide, on the ballot again, 6-year terms in the Senate. Do you expect to run for re-election in 2024?
I do.
This is a midterm election. It's 2022. What are the odds, in your view, that the Democrats hold on to the Senate?
I think it's a toss-up. right now, Tim. I think that a lot is going to depend on what we do in the interval between right now and the election in November. As you know, in politics, that's a very short window. So we have a lot to get done. And we've got to get the voting rights stuff done. We've got to get climate stuff done. We've got to get Build Back Better's other provisions also done. And I think we've got to frame the party.
We have just 15 seconds left.
Really willing to fight.
Okay, sorry to interrupt you there. The show ends when it ends. U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, thanks so much for joining us. If you missed it, it's on WPRI.com. For Ted Nesi, I'm Tim White. We'll see you next week on Newsmakers.